Nous allons maintenant passer au professeur Zaccetti, qui, donc je me permets de vous présenter d'abord, enfin on n'a pas à le présenter bien sûr, grand spécialiste du bouddhisme chinois de la première époque. Le professeur Zaccetti est pour moi une sorte de Giuseppe Tucci Redivivus, puisqu'il a, il maîtrise à la fois non seulement le sanskrit, le pali, mais plusieurs formes de prakrit, le chinois bouddhique dans ses premières manifestations qui sont extrêmement difficiles à lire, même pour les spécialistes du bouddhisme, et bien sûr le tibétain. Mais cette formation traditionnelle ne l'empêche pas d'avoir des idées tout à fait novatrices. C'est vraiment l'un des grands représentants des nouvelles études bouddhiques actuelles. Je suis très heureux qu'il ait accepté de venir participer pour nous parler de quelque chose qui est très important dans le domaine de la sinoglossie. C'est que justement la sinoglossie n'est pas quelque chose le chinois classique n'est pas quelque chose d'immuable. Il a profondément changé au contact des textes bouddhiques. La langue chinoise elle-même, et même dans ses manifestations vernaculaires, a changé au contact du bouddhisme. Et le professeur Zaccetti va nous parler aujourd'hui d'une de ces périodes charnière de la formation du chinois bouddhique, puisqu'il s'agit du 4e siècle avec Daoan et la langue des traductions en chinois des textes bouddhiques.
Thank you, Professor Bert, for your kind invitation, also these very kind words that somehow prepared my initial apology, because in a sense, when I saw the program of this conference, I realized that my own presentation, the title I had submitted to Professor Robert, was actually not quite in line with the topic. But I'll try my best to present things from an angle that maybe might have an interest for the colleagues present here today. In many ways, so I work on Chinese Buddhist translations. That's my main research areas. Here is just this is a sentence I quite like, just a presentation to give you a kind of quick overview of the field. And in many ways, the Chinese Buddhist canon, which collects these corpus of translations, I think can say lies at the heart of the phenomenon which is being discussed in this workshop. I think it's possible to argue that historically, Buddhism played a crucial role in establishing East Asia as a cultural continuum, based, among other things, on a shared language of culture, that is, written Chinese. And yet, this imposing scriptural collection is not without problems and even some paradoxes. And here are some that just came to mind. First of all, we have here one of the largest corpora of translated texts produced in the pre-modern world, and yet is a corpus of translations without real originals, because what we actually have when we compare Chinese Buddhist translations with Indian counterparts are parallels, not really originals in a specific way. This is due to the particular dynamics of historical development of Buddhist texts in India. Another paradox, which I think is closer to the topic of this symposium, and I'm just raising an issue, I don't have an answer for this, but I'm just proposing. As is well known, Buddhism embraced from an early day translation as a key method for spreading its message. It was, as, for example, Richard Solomon said, it became from a very early period, perhaps even from the beginning, a religion of translation. So Chinese translations are just one of the most significant manifestations of a process which actually started much, much earlier in India. From an earlier period, we know Buddhists allowed the use of different vernacular, so as the Buddhist teaching moved around in the Indian subcontinent, was rendered into local vernacular. So we can look at Chinese Buddhist translations as you know, a kind of extreme manifestation of a much broader cultural approach, which is characteristic of Buddhism as a whole. And yet, so while the Buddha, the Chinese canon itself, is the result of this enormous translation work, when Chinese Buddhist texts were introduced into some neighboring cultural areas, especially in East Asia, they were no longer translated into the local vernaculars. So this is an interesting phenomenon. It didn't always happen. It didn't, you know, it wasn't always that it happened in this way, because, for example, in other areas, Xixia, for example, also in Sogdian, we do have corpora of texts translated from Chinese versions. But East Asia, which is relevant here, well, that we have an interesting phenomenon. The language of translations is no longer translatable. And so Chinese, Buddhist Chinese, in a sense, became a sort of secondary original, or was canonized as an original sacred language, which is a very interesting phenomenon, and it has also parallels elsewhere. Why? That would be interesting also to discuss, maybe in the context of this symposium. There is also another paradox that I would like to bring to your attention, which I think is also related to the point I've just made. And the paradox is, this is to give you, meanwhile, as I speak, a sense of very, very rough outline. I wouldn't even subscribe entirely to this, but just to give you a sense of what we are talking about. Now, another paradox, which is related to the point that I've just made, that is the specific language used to produce these Chinese Buddhist translations. So the paradox is this, in a sense. It raises a question. And I really became aware of this, fully aware, when I encountered the work of Matteo Ricci. Now, what's the relationship? Well, there is no relationship, but in a sense, Matteo Ricci and his fellow Catholic missionaries active at the end of the Ming, they were facing parallel problems to those that were, you know, the early, in a much earlier period, Buddhist pilgrims had to deal with. And the problem of how to introduce new ideas, a new creed into the Chinese cultural world. So what I think what one would do in that context would be to use classical Chinese, to try and write and use classical Chinese as a mean to, as a way to transmit one's text, especially if the target is, or one of the aim is to be received within the broader Chinese cultural context. Here is a text that for me was really inspirational. Now it's become a set piece of whenever I give a presentation on Chinese Buddhist translation, I tend to start from this. Okay, so this is a quotation from the beginning of one of Matteo Ricci's work. I'll give a translation later, but I would say if you look at these, this looks pretty much like a text composed in Chinese. Whether it's good Chinese, to me, looks good. I'm not sufficiently proficient in classical Chinese to say whether this is really good. It looks like a piece of Chinese prose. Actually, this is a translation. It was discovered later. It's a sort of translation. It's not a very literal. Occasionally, it's quite literal. For example, the first sentence is a relatively literal translation from a very important book, Greek philosophical book, the Handbook or Enchiridion of Epictetus. Now, this is an interesting, why do I find this relevant for understanding Chinese Buddhist translation? Because precisely here is a model, is a language, which is perfectly efficient for producing a sophisticated translation into Chinese. Here is my translation of Ricci's version. You can compare, this is translation from the Greek. More or less, I mean, we could comment at length, but there are passages which are aligned. Now, the interesting thing is that to the best of my knowledge, in the massive Buddhist canon, there is no one single text that's really translated in the way that Ricci translated, paraphrased, but also translated Epictetus' work. Now, this is raises an interesting question. We don't find, so Ricci's work was not designed to look like a translation. It's a translation, but it was so well disguised that it was only discovered after many years. On the other hand, and this is the point that I think it's important to make, Chinese Buddhist translations are designed to look like translations. This is an important point. They are never, so the idea that this should be presented as something which was immediately, you know, part, digestible from a Chinese audience, that's never crossed the minds of any Chinese Buddhist translators known to me. Now, this is an interesting point because we are, in a sense, brings to light to the surface or raises issues about what these people were really trying to do, what game they were playing. And also, I think it counters certain easy narratives about Chinese Buddhist texts coming to China and trying to be presented as Taoist texts and things like that. Well, that actually doesn't quite work on the basis of my experience and just looking at the language of the text. So what the Buddhists tried to do, they would have certainly felt that translated like Ricci did would have been a bit too wen or refined or artificial, if you want. So as a matter of fact, they never used wen yan, let's say literary Chinese, as the language for translations. They were perfectly masterful in the use of wen yan for writing other kinds of texts, for example, commentaries, historiographical works, and so on and so forth. But when they were playing the game of translating the teachings of Buddhism into Chinese, they never used this language, which one might think this is the natural language to use when you introduce something in the broader cultural context. So there is an interesting issue here, perhaps even a paradox. Now, just to give you a sense of what they did, on the other hand, and you can compare mentally with Ricci's translations, I give you some examples of early Chinese Buddhist translations. So in the early period, the early phase, I would say from the 2nd to the 4th century CE, we have a phase of experimentation. So different groups of translators, they started to be active in the then imperial capital of Luoyang from the middle of the 2nd century CE, as far as we know. And different groups used different translation approaches. And so we have with very different results. So here is an example to which I would like to come back. This is a translator it's quite dear to me, in spite of the language of the text. So this is a case, I give a very, very, very literal translation just to give you a sense of how these might read in Chinese. This is a translation approach used by An Shigao, who is the earliest name or figure of translator about whom we have any reliable record, was active from the middle of the 2nd century. Now, this is utterly, it does work, it makes sense, especially if you have in mind the Indic text that this is translating, but as a Chinese text, this doesn't, let's say it's pretty odd in many, many ways. This is a translation style which, in a sense, had as a basic approach to reflect closely the syntax of the original Indic text. So the word order, there are problems, and so on and so forth. Another alternative early school of, or let's say translation school, is another very important translator who was active roughly in the same period, some 20 years later. This is a text which also doesn't fully conform, certainly doesn't conform with literary Chinese at all, but for different reasons. This is a text, it's a translation style which is more open to vernacular, to colloquial Chinese. So we have some construction, not particularly the use of post-verbal complements, widespread use of polysyllabic words, and so on and so forth. This is a text which, in a sense, looks more natural in the sense that it's more open to colloquial Chinese, but it's, again, for another reason, it's completely different from Wen Yan. We do have some translators in the early period who went closer to the adoption of a sort of literary Chinese. This is an example, Kan Senghui, who came from an area which was mentioned earlier, so what would have been what would be now northern Vietnam. And this is not really a translation, in my view, it's more a compilation of narrative texts based on Indian narrative materials, but it's not really a translation. This reads much more like a nice Chinese text, although there are significant differences in terms of vocabulary and also here and there also in syntax. So different approaches. Now, if we look at the development of the language of Chinese Buddhist translation, what we notice, this has been described, so I'm saying nothing that's new, it's been described quite well by Eric Zürcher, among other scholars, there is a gradual tendency to establish a sort of church, what he calls a church language. So a distinct form of written Chinese, which is, in a sense, open to certain aspects of literary Chinese, but retain certain features which are at odds with standard literary Chinese. And this is also a very important cultural process, because you know we need to ask why did they do so, and so, and there are good reasons, which you know we could discuss, depending on the time. In many respects, so this idea, this development of a distinctively Buddhist idiom, in fact, it also parallels developments that were happening in the Indian context, where we notice the development of specific forms of Sanskrit, which are typically Buddhist. So it is also possible, this is an issue which is certainly requires more research, that some of the, I'm actually quite convinced that some of the practices that were adopted by Chinese translators to produce these distinctive idioms were actually influenced certainly from by the Chinese context, but also by ideas about languages that are of Indian Buddhist origins. So it's a complex cultural phenomenon, but the point is that towards the 4th, 5th century, at the turn of the 4th and to the 5th century, we have a gradual formation of a stable, distinct, artificial, of course, these are all artificial languages in a sense, but we witness the formation of a specific idiom for translating Buddhist texts into Chinese. This is the period I would like to look at, so zoom in on this period, also place, because this transition really is centered in the city of Chang'an, which was a very important center of translation activities at around that time. So again, end of the 4th, beginning of the 5th century, there is the very famous name of Kumarajiva, who arrived and, in a sense, inherited a certain experience of translation that had already started in the preceding years, and in a sense, it gave it moved this language in a certain direction and established something of a standard. So, in fact, we can clearly see that this idiom that took shape at the time was very, very influential on all subsequent translations. Now, what I would like to do is to look at one particular figure, Tawan, who played an important role in this transition. Tawan is an extremely important figure in the history of early Chinese Buddhism, active in various areas, reformer of the monastic order, the father of Buddhist bibliography, Mulu Xue, I mean the bibliographical science that's so important in China, and but also specifically in for Buddhists. So in a sense, the establishment of a real Buddhist canon owes an awful lot to this figure. He was also, in his late years, when he was taken as a kind of high-ranking captive to Chang'an in 379, he was active as an organizer of translation work, and also something of a theorist. So he's quite well known for having proposed these Wushu Pen Sanbu Yi. These are apparently guidelines for translation activities. These are transmitted, are present in a preface. There is a sizable corpus, body of prefaces by Tauan that survives. Most of his works have disappeared, but there is a substantial corpus of prefaces that have survived. One of these prefaces, Tauan expresses, articulates these guidelines, 8 points. Now, it is extremely difficult, in fact, to understand even what they mean. There are great, great problems. There is quite a literature on these supposed guidelines, so we don't really know often what they mean, let alone how they were applied, if they were applied in practical terms, as some sources do suggest. So what I would like to do, actually, is to focus on one of these points, the second. This is the quotation with my translation. There are several translations available. This is a kind of provisional translation I put together recently. This is the second of these 5 points. So the 5 points are the first of these guidelines. These 5 points are probably points on which, as I said, it's not entirely clear what he's saying, but they seem to be points where a departure from the originals is unavoidable somehow. There is a certain loss, the Shiben, a loss of, with respect to the originals, that somehow Tauan seems to consider unavoidable. This is due to different word order, and this is the second point. This is interesting, and I would like to focus on it, because the language he's using here, zhi and wen, these two words. So the second point, foreign canonical texts give precedence to what is natural. I mean, my translation, I know, are all questionable, but yeah, zhi, what is rough, is not artificial, is not polished, whereas Qin people, let's say Chinese, like what is refined. And when translating to Chinese, one has to adapt this rough, natural, which is the nature of the originals, have to adapt to the taste of the audience. Now, if we look at the whole of Tauan's surviving corpus, so there are a sizable body of prefaces, and also commentary, as I will show, we see that he used these pair of terms, zhi wen, which are also used by other authors. So these are pretty much part of early Chinese Buddhist discourse on translations. So quite apart from this specific articulation in the context of these 5 points, this is an established pair of notions in early Chinese Buddhist discourse on the problems of translating text. But Tauan uses very, very systematically. I've noticed at least 6, 7, 8 occurrences of this pair in the body of his prefaces. And actually, in this, so taking all his works together, we are in a better position to understand, I think, what he was really trying to say. This is a preface, as most of his early prefaces, and I would say almost all of early Chinese Buddhist prefaces are prefaces to commentaries, not directly to the text, to the translation. So this is a commentary, it's a preface to a particular commentary by Tauan where he compared two different versions of an Indian scripture, more or less, or let's say of parallel versions of an Indian scriptures. He compared, and here he looks at the work of one very important, Zhu Fahu, also known as Dharmaraksha, one of the most important early Chinese translators active in the third century. And, you know, in a sense, there is certainly a note of criticism here. The text is not particularly easy to understand. This is interesting because actually we can clearly see that these, so certain translators who are labeled or whose work is labeled as being, let's say, over, you know, excessively natural and unrefined, or so on and so forth, There are actually translators that Tawan studied in his youth, and he greatly admired, and he spared no words in piling words of great admiration of them. Dharmaraksha is one case. That Anshigao, whom I mentioned earlier, so this early translator, is another one, but he still uses this category Zhi. And this is an interesting category because, as we can see, the use of Zhi, especially in, well, we can see this clearly in this formulation, is not really referred to the translation or the translators. It's actually used to, I wouldn't say criticize, but it's a very interesting passage, actually, when you think of all the implications. This is actually used to refer to the intrinsic nature of the language of the originals. So when the translation was labeled as Zhi, what it means is that it was a very, very, let's say, transparent glass through which Tawan could see actually how the original was structured. And the transparency of this glass brings together an interesting situation because on the one hand, he's prepared, exactly as here, he's prepared to praise the translators for the faithfulness to translate, like in this case, shi bu jia shi. So he didn't change or tamper or over polish the originals, but at the same time, this preservation of the original nature of the text that causes problems. Texts are not perfectly understandable, and so on and so forth. I think it's important for understanding what's actually meant, which are the implications of this pair, is to look at the source of it, which is very clear. It's absolutely clear that Tawan and all the other translators that were using this pair of terms were all referring to this very important, famous passage from the Lun Yu, the Dialogues of Confucius. This is a text that was a formative text for all, every person of a certain culture in the medieval period. So no matter whether Buddhist or not, all would have known this text. And in fact, all the, not translations, of course, but all the other works composed by learned Chinese Buddhists in the medieval period, they are full of echoes, references, quotations to certain classics, but Lun Yu is particularly present. So there is no doubt that this is the framing. Now, what is very interesting in this passage is that, in a sense, this is a text that would have had a kind of natural perfect resonance for somebody with Tawan's background. Because in a sense, this is quite interestingly, is a sort of Confucian version of the basic Buddhist teaching of the middle way. The Buddhism presents itself as the Madhyama Pratipada, the middle way, between different sets of extremes. Now, here is a clear depiction of a middle course, which is the only, the only correct one. And the important thing to notice here is that both aspects, zhi and wen, in isolation, are intrinsically negative. They're intrinsically, is only when zhi bing bing, so only the balance, or when they're balanced, then it does the trick. In this case, maybe at the moral level, but also at the textual level. So this is a very important to bear in mind. So using zhi to classify even the originals, actually, has interesting, quite a subtle, interesting implication. Now, the last thing in the 3 minutes I have, we have a source which is quite interesting, the only surviving commentary by Tawan. He was a very prolific commentator. Unfortunately, all of his works are lost, apart from this one. This is a commentary on the very translation by this Anshigao I quoted at the beginning. This is interesting in many, many respects. It's not much studied. There have been a couple of recent articles. One very interesting, I have to say, published last year by a Chinese scholar whose name I don't remember, Liu Chanting. I just seen the article. It was published last year, which very interestingly discusses this commentary as a source for understanding Tawan's ideas about translation, which is exactly Now, this is important from my point of view because we can see in this comment, through this comment, how somebody like Tawan was actually reading a Zhi text, a Zhi sort of translation. Now, what he does, he adopts several strategies, the most striking and interesting of which is the use of paraphrase. I would even call intralingual translation. So what Tawan does in about 20 passages, at least, in this commentary, is to reformulate the basic text by An Shigao. Here is the passage I quoted before. So this is the passage you've just seen, with this very, very broken, let's say, in the Indic Chinese syntax. Now, what Tawan does here, as in many other places, he reformulates, puts the whole thing in sort of good Wenyan. Notice, for example, this is one striking thing, is the Iche Anang. Now, this Iche, also if you look at the Pali parallels, has to be an adverb. But it's very odd. It's between, there is adverb, a sort of vocative, ananda, and then the verb actually is much lower than that. So it's all quite odd. So what Tawan does is, wherever he gets this Iche, in his reformulation, he renders with pu. It works much better. So he does this, which is quite interesting as an operation. So in a sense, he's sort of saying, what does it say? Does it say this should sound this and this and that? Is it proposing an alternative translation language as a model? I would say probably not. He was actually using a well-established exegetical technique that was already adopted by earlier commentators, secular commentators. A very important example is Zhaoqi's Mengzi Zhangju of the Han period, Tung Han, the Eastern Han period, which also adopts this kind of intralingual translation systematically. But at the same time, it's interesting because we can notice where he saw a problem in the syntax. But he did not certainly advocate these as the solution. Now, what is the solution? I think if we go back to the Lun Yu passage, it's very clear that the kind of solution that Tawan had in mind, just by using that terminology, he was gesturing at this solution. Solution is a sort of compromise. The compromise between two key needs that Buddhist translators had to confront. On the one hand, producing something that's readable, and to some degree acceptable to a broader audience. But at the same time, and this is just as crucial, and is also the reason why, in the end, they never wrote a translation like Matteo Ricci did, is that they needed to preserve a certain degree of identity. The use of language as a badge of identity is crucial in Indian Buddhism, where different schools are characterized by the use of a certain vernacular, for example, or Sanskrit. Somehow, I think this idea that the language of the Buddha has to be different, cannot be the same of, you know, secular text. It somehow parallels the nervousness about the use of Sanskrit in Indian Buddhism, which was later, you know, overcome, and certain schools, Sarvastivadin especially, did use Sanskrit. It's all extremely interesting. But somehow there is a nervousness about going Sanskrit in fully fledged. The same thing happened here. So what I think it's important to bear in mind, it is incredible, just calling everything Chinese doesn't really help a lot. We do really, we are confronted by several different idioms in the Buddhist canon, the use of which, this is like having, you know, an orchestra with different instruments. And playing one would send a message to a certain part of the audience, playing another one would send a message with a different resonance to another part of the audience. But it was quite crucial to have this sort of compromise, this language, middle way sort of language. And I think that this is somehow, although I cannot document that these ideas, as we can infer from close reading, from Mantao, actually, you know, to what extent they shaped what happened. But if we look at the idiom that was produced by famous Kumarajiva's translation team, it is something of that sort, especially in its most successful works, the Lotus Sutra translation, the Vimalakirtini Nirdesha, and so on and so forth. So I would close here. And I'm aware that I raised more questions than I could answer, but I really would welcome also later if you have, you know, views or ideas about this. Thank you.